Welcome to the Simpleton Podcast, the podcast that solves all the world's problems and starts a few more, hopefully with Christ. Laura Heeman, how are you doing?
Doing well, Clark Massey.
All right, we have a very pragmatic episode today. We're taking a pause from that boring missioner's manual and getting into some trouble. We feel the need to talk about this because the world seems to be at this moment of crisis. And by crisis, I mean a point of change. You know, I had a friend who worked at Crisis Magazine around 2001, and the sex abuse crisis happened. And it was very weird to be at Crisis Magazine because it seemed like your whole magazine was named after the sex abuse crisis.
Yeah.
And so this friend of mine had to, whenever we went out, had to explain to everyone, crisis just means change point. It's not necessarily a negative thing. Anyway, Laura and I have been discussing the current thought bubble in the world. All right. So if you take the Overton window is the collection of political things that you can discuss that are considered acceptable, right? So if you have an idea completely out of left field, people aren't even ready to deal with it, or you might become a pariah for even mentioning it, those ideas are outside the Overton window, right?
Yeah.
So what's funny is if you take that Overton window, you kind of can draw a line around these ideas and say that's kind of the thought of your time. This has put us in a weird situation because how would you describe the thought of our time?
I would say it is fragile and very protective of itself, and it's not Christian or Catholic necessarily.
It seems to me that it actually is quite easily anti-Catholic. And if, you know, if it's not flaring up right now, there's stuff in this thought bubble that is very dangerous, you know, to our religion.
I mean, I think if you... Here near DC, I feel like if you are Catholic, you might be careful where you bring that up. You know, so we're at that point where it's like you're not publicly saying like, I'm a Catholic and I believe in all the teachings of the church, you know.
Right. Like to say I believe in all the teachings of the church would be very hard to say like in front of DC City Council.
Yeah. Or like our neighbors in the neighborhood, you know.
Right. Yeah. You know, we just read the biography of the first bishop in our area when he was just a missionary priest from Ireland. And he did not wear the collar because there was so much anti-Catholicism that he couldn't just like ride down the road wearing a collar, you know.
Wow.
And there was points where he got beat up because they wanted to kill a priest, you know. Anyway, I don't want to exaggerate where we're at, but like we're in this situation where there's all these thoughts swimming around. A lot of them are contradictory, and that makes the whole thing very fragile. And Catholicism is kind of a pariah in it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's two reasons why I think it's very fragile. And that's also why I think when you said it's protective, when you have something very fragile, you have to be very protective.
Yeah.
You have to lash out, you know, to protect it. So the two reasons why I think it's fragile are, one, an uneducated person can easily poke holes in it. And I saw this because I was watching Irish news on YouTube. It was just like talking about the immigration crisis in Ireland. And it just had like people from small towns in Ireland who their town, it was like a situation where their town had one hotel. The whole hotel was rented out by the government for immigrants and they don't have anything to do during the day. And they're all men. They're all men in their 20s, you know? And so they all just stand around at the park all day. And so then none of the women and none of the kids want to use the park because there's just a bunch of foreign guys who don't speak the language standing around at the park.
Yeah.
And their point was like, even if these are all nice angelic men, this is just like not cool.
I mean, it's like if there were like 10 American men hanging out at the park, I wouldn't go to the park with my kids.
10 single guys in their 20s hanging out at the park is not a great, comfortable scene, you
know? Right. So it's like you're going to call it, not you, people are going to want to say that's so xenophobic or whatever, you know, or racist or whatever. And it's just like, anyway, go ahead.
So. Yeah. So then, you know, the kind of simple Irish person is like saying this and she's saying, you know, I never went to college and I don't care what you say about me and blah, blah. And then in order to show both sides of the issue, they have to go now interview someone who speaks for the government. And he then addresses the issue. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that while he was talking, I felt comforted because he had this like wonderful, like, no better way of speaking, you know, that you can develop by having a master's degree usually. And at the end of it, it was like he hadn't addressed any of the real concerns.
Yeah.
You know, but you were just like, if I want to pretend like you're handling it, I could, yeah. You know, and that's not a good situation for a country. When a country doesn't have simple answers for why they do things.
Yeah.
And in our society as a whole doesn't, things are getting treacherous.
Yeah. I think we're doing a thing that's very weird right now where it's like, you know, people are saying like, I'm worried because I had this experience, and we're saying, no, no, no. Anecdotal evidence is not valid. And we need the researchers and the experts and whatever to tell us. And it's like, for all of humanity, we've relied on our lived experience and on the authority of people around us that we trust, you know, like the authority, not the expertise, but like my mom or my neighbor is a trustworthy person and I trust his instinct, you know, but now we can't, you know, no, no, no. We need to do this very complicated thing where we're going to analyze these numbers and you can't follow the math that I'm doing anyway. And, you know, because, right.
It's kind of the Wizard of Oz, trust me, you know, or there's nothing behind the curtain.
Yeah.
You know? And the other reason why it's fragile is that, like, if you just went back 100 years, someone from that time period, both people now don't sympathetically understand their worldview, and that person would not understand what we're doing now, you know? So we're kind of divorced from our own history, like, even from within two generations.
Yeah.
We're kind of, like, on such a strange path that we couldn't explain it to them, and frankly, we're not even open to understanding what they're thinking.
Yeah.
You know? So because of that, I consider this like this equilibrium we're at, but it's a very unstable equilibrium and it's got to change. That's why I'd call it a crisis, you know, could change for the good, could change for the bad. You know what you're saying about that, like trusting your common sense. I have found
or just
that,
like your experience, you know,
right. Lived experience. Yeah. Right. And I found that that's been true. Like we do something at Simple House where we call it like social justice awareness tours where like, you know, we're in spring break season right now. So a spring breaker comes in, I put them in the big van and we drive around and we look at people dealing drugs on the street. We look at maybe a woman who's prostituting, you know, just drive by, just say, hey, what do you want to ask?
What's going on there. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Look at closed schools, look at abandoned neighborhoods, look at public housing, look at Section 8 housing, look at homeless shelters, look at like a section of the city that the homelessness is clustered in, you know, and this is all what a scientist would call primary source evidence, you know what I mean? Like, this is direct evidence of all these things. Right. And I found that I had missionaries who'd been at Simple House a few years and they would go to do a social justice awareness tour. And then they would go read articles about Kansas City written by an academic who lives, you know, at a university an hour away about, and then give the social justice awareness tour as if reading from that article. You know, and I'm like, no, what the heck are you doing?
Like, value here.
People have come here for primary source evidence and you're just giving them a college class's take. Yeah. Like you have something better here to offer, you know, and something that weirdly enough seems to contradict some of the things that guy says,
right.
You know, and that's the interesting part. And that's why these college students are here, is to learn not the message, you know, but like the reality and the contradictions. And I've seen that also with people who just come and start inner city missions, that they'll have this like set idea of what poverty is and what the problem is. And 2 years later, I know, cause I've hung out with them and I've seen them confront things that contradict their worldview over and over again, and they haven't updated their beliefs.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost like they trust the college course they took more than they trust what they saw in the streets when they got here. And I'm sure journalists are doing this all the time too.
Oh yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's just interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I think it's interesting to ask how did we get to a bubble that is so fragile? And I think that this like interest in classical education is both part of the explanation and part of the solution. Like, in a sense, our thought right now is at the end of a long string of Western thought and worldviews, right? And like I said, this, where we're at right now, doesn't jive with 100 years ago at all. Like, they wouldn't understand it and we couldn't understand them at this point, right?
Yeah, like if you're Catholic, a lot of your sort of ideas about what a person is and how a person should live have made sense for many hundreds of years, though they do not right now.
That's true. But it also makes sense that if you were in a strong position as a society and had a well-rounded worldview, mm-hmm. you would both understand and sympathize with other people's worldviews, even if you disagree.
Yeah.
You know, like that would be a more powerful, that would not be a bubble. You right. know, that would be actually just a good worldview that,
yeah.
oh, hey, 100 years ago, they thought this. Here's why they thought it. We disagree. Here's our reasons. And here's how what we're trying to achieve here. Right. Like that's a good way of operating. Right. You don't see that right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think one way to think of the classical education model, and this I don't think is the way they're selling it, but is to say, hey, let's, in a sense, understand the worldviews, at least in the West, at least in the societies where we're coming from, throughout time.
Mm-hmm.
And through that, you will have a much healthier worldview right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, you're not living in ancient Greece and no, you're not living in Thomas Aquinas' day, but you'll be able to build a better view of the world now if you understand the way they thought about it.
Right. Because you sympathize with people from another time, you understand kind of what's motivated people for many years and not just at this particular moment. Yeah. And I think I wish I could, I don't remember who it was. So sorry, whoever this person is. I just heard like an academic, it was like a Black person in academia say, you know, it's like, we have all these like young students saying like racism is so bad right now, but they have no sense of what it was like. Like they're comparing it to nothing. You know, they're just saying, look at it. It's so bad. But they can't say, have we progressed? Has it gotten worse? Cause they have like no sense of history at all in our country, even like very recent history, last 50-100 years.
Right. I realized when I was working with kids from the inner city that like, and frankly, I hate to say this, this might be true of some kids from the burbs, that like they really didn't have a sense of whether or not the ancient Egyptians and the knights of the medieval era, which came first.
I suspect that's true of a lot.
Right. And
people right now.
I don't know that that's a super important little fact, but it shows an incredible ignorance, you know?
Well, I think there was like a statistic right now, or I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, it was like a huge number of kids and they didn't know who the Nazis were or like what the Holocaust was. And it was like 11% of people interviewed thought the Jews caused the Holocaust, like were the perpetrators of the Holocaust. You know, that's like 1 out of 10 kids thought, you know, the Jews were the Nazis. And this is before things got so hot with, you know, Palestine
right.
and Israel. But yeah,
I wonder if the reason why this fragile thought bubble came about was not just a loss of, say, good literature and all those things, but literally a corruption of history itself.
Yeah.
You know, like when we quit teaching, like history is a great, you know, a starting point for understanding old worldviews,
mm-hmm.
you know, but it can't just be about facts and dates. It has to be about really understanding what happened.
Yeah.
You know, but I feel like that could be how we got here.
Yeah. I'm going to say one more thing about that.
Yeah, go ahead.
A thing that pains many older millennials like myself, girls, women, is the trajectory of the American Girl doll thing. And it's like in the, you know, first set of historical view dolls, you have, you know, like the best friend dies of cholera. Someone's father is sold into slavery in another family and she and her mother escapes. Like, it's like these like big, painful, horrible things. Like you move away from Sweden, never to see your grandparents again, you know, to come to the new world, like to not the new world, but you know, to the US. And they've switched more to this model of, like, McKenna isn't the best on the gymnastics team. How will she, you know, survive eighth grade? I don't, that's maybe not quite, but it's like stuff like that. And it's like, we can't trust or let the girls like imagine themselves in a different time. Like, are they too stupid or too self-centered or like, what's the problem, you know? And the thing that is, can be great about literature is it like helps you kind of know yourself by putting yourself in another person's time and another person's point of view, you know? And so I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what is the solution to this? So the classical education model is a pretty good way of addressing this, right? Another thought, though, is that I feel like sometimes what a real Catholic attitude would be to kind of like take what is true from anywhere and own it, because that is of God, right?
Yeah.
And if it's coming from Hinduism or if it's coming from other some other culture, that's fine. But we do believe there's something special about the West, which was so formed by Christianity.
Yeah.
You know, what you don't want to do is to create an equally limited thought bubble that you call, that's a Catholic thought bubble.
Yeah.
You know, that you've constructed to replace the current thought bubble. One, because it won't be the new equilibrium and it's just going to be a project that has no chance of success. And two, because it's not really a Catholic thought bubble. It's not really Catholic at the end of the day.
Yeah. And I think it's like the thought bubble is, you know, bubbles are easy to burst, right? And so it's like you're fearful of new ideas because in a way it would be kind of admitting you're fearful of new ideas because maybe they're going to replace your Catholic ideas, which means are your Catholic ideas very good, you know? And if your ideas are good, then there's a way that you can engage other ideas.
The people I see working on this, though, who seem to enjoy the idea of like creating the new Catholic thought bubble, they are correct that whatever they're creating is so better than what we're in right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, clearly they're coming up with a better bubble, but it's still at the end of the day, a bubble, you know?
Right, yeah, yeah.
Which won't be for the good of Catholicism. I think the question now, though, and part of the question of why I think you and I were interested in this podcast was, where's all this going? You know, mm-hmm. and how does it affect the kingdom? And how does it affect us as Catholics and, you know, our families and stuff, right? And I thought an interesting question would be, how would I pose you the thought experiment and you flesh it out? Okay. Imagine you're the King of England or Queen of England, probably King. I don't know if there was a major queen before Queen Elizabeth, before Henry VIII, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're King of a Catholic England. What is the job of your government?
Protection probably of the people and the land, and the land's resources, and then using those resources for prosperity.
Well, I mean, I don't know that last part's right.
Okay.
Do you think the king managed resources?
Maybe not using. Yeah, right. But you worry about prosperity in the land.
Right. You want to see your people do well, right? The health of the people.
Yeah.
But really, your only kind of like actual mechanisms to work on are like armies, securing the borders, maybe some of the king's highways.
Yeah.
Maybe a trade treaty.
Yeah.
Maybe you could send out an explorer once in a while. I don't know. But it's only a couple of things, right?
Yeah.
Almost sounds, weirdly enough, libertarian, even though you're a monarch, right? And then you kind of go to like our current government. Now try to do the same thing. What are the jobs of the U.S. government right now as understood by the American people?
School, transportation, welfare, sort of moral, policing,
Let's
military.
Get more specific. Like you're, that's pretty broad, but it's like, we're literally asking our government to make us not racist.
Yeah.
And not sexist.
Yeah.
You know, like that's a valid concern of government. Housing people who are poor is the concern of government. All the medieval concerns are still the concern of government.
Medical.
Medical, managing the medical,
mm-hmm.
Both providing access to the poor and also keeping it safe, the environment.
I mean, funding it also.
Oh, yeah. Funding new developments in that, right?
I mean, funding hospitals, funding like... They're funding schools, they're funding hospitals, they're funding everything, you know. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Upper higher education.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like, that's kind of incredible.
Yeah.
You know, like, and if you think of it, if you thought of that as like, and that's kind of even at a federal level, like there's still a lot of county and city level stuff too.
Yeah.
And if you thought of it, like, could a president or even a president with a united Congress even do that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like if we took the best CEOs of all the best corporations, could they even do that? If we had the most talented managers that America has, could they even manage what we have supposed government is supposed to do at this point?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And then to throw in this other weird thing, which I need to give you credit for thinking of this, but it's like when you assign government all these tasks, like Catholicism tends to focus on the family unit,
mm-hmm.
right? And the almost like the hyper-local community, the parish, right? And the government, for it to operate well, needs you to think in terms of being a citizen, not think in terms of being a family member and local community member, right? Because if you think in terms of being a family member and local community member, you prioritize those things above bureaucracy, and you then corrupt bureaucracy with nepotism and favoritism and all these things, because you value your local community and helping them get ahead more than you value the government's role in making you less racist or whatever the project of that bureaucracy is.
Yeah.
Right. It's almost like if you have that more limited government, you say, look, we're going to be for protecting the nation and a couple high level trade treaties. And we expect that when you operate within this realm, you are a statesman, you are a citizen, and you do not prioritize your family above that. That's a much more limited ask than to say, hey, the government's like 30% of the whole economy. And whenever you operate with the government, we want you to act not in your self-interest, not in your family's interest. We want you to value the government and the society above all that.
Yeah. Right. The government's going to be involved in building every like single building around you, acquiring all the resources necessary for whatever, you know, and but you can't hire your friend that's a contractor, and you can't favor men over women, and you can't, you know, there's like right now all these like sort of ethical things that we're trying to.
And that's like an impossible ask because you will hire your own friend and you will deal with your friend, the contractor, you know, because they're just more important at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So given that this is kind of the situation, let's kind of tackle this idea of like, are we hopeful that this crisis moment in this thought bubble will somehow resolve in a good way into a healthier equilibrium? Your silence is deafening, Laura.
I know.
I have a real problem with it because I know how to add a layer to government. You know, like if we had a really good idea, I kind of, and there was enough interest in favor of it, you know, special interests by definition, you know, in favor of it. I think we could promote government, you know, adding a new thing onto Medicaid or adding a new, you know, environmental watchdog group or adding a new layer onto the incredibly layered system we already have. Right. And there's a way to do that.
I don't know anything about coding, but I guess if you have like a sloppy code, it has like a lot of appendages, you know, like, oh, you saw somewhere where it wasn't working, so you added this little appendage.
A patch.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's much more difficult to go back to the beginning and rewrite the code properly, you know, so that it's working well throughout. It's a lot easier to add all these little appendages, but then it's very sloppy.
Well, it'd be like, you know, Microsoft came out with like Windows 10 or something like that. Like, and if they keep patching it, it keeps getting slower. And the patches always have this like sacrifice, you know, that they make, right?
Yeah.
And ultimately, Microsoft has to say, we are no longer working on that operating system.
We're throwing Windows 10 out.
We're going back to the basics and reworking it from the beginning, right? And the U.S. government doesn't have that type of mechanism, right? And the only time we've seen things like that happen that I can think of, they've never happened in the U.S., are kind of like this radical thing that happened in El Salvador, where they took an incredible turn, and same with Argentina, and they both happened when the government essentially failed.
Yeah.
You know, and they were basically in a failed state by the time they switched directions.
Yeah.
And I don't want, there's no way to like take the complex code or the complex, you know, operation that is the U.S. government and start scaling it back to the medieval idea.
Yeah. You know? I mean, and we can't be like, okay, you know, April 4th, we're going to reboot the U.S.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
I'm going to end with a hopeful message here, but here's the, here's the crazy, like, failed state message. So Milei is the new ruler in president. It's dark world out here. Milei is the new president of Argentina, and he's canceling certain government offices and programs. And he says it's going to get worse before it gets better, but it's kind of too early. Like, how long has he been in power? Like 3-4 months?
December, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just a couple months, right? So we don't know whether or not his reforms are going to work. It will be very interesting to check in 2 years and to see where they're at, right?
But Argentina was like at 150% inflation. Like, I think people had very strong reactions. People I know were either very for or very against Milei, you know, and one fear was that he was going to ruin Argentina. And I think the people that were for were like, we literally can't get any worse.
Right. Argentina has been ruined.
Yeah.
They've had hyperinflation twice in the last like 20 years. The economy's been wrecked.
Yeah.
And like, I love the idea of trying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, like, what I hate is like inner city school districts where they will not allow radical reform after like a half century of failure.
Yeah.
You know, that drives me nuts. Mm-hmm. Like, if the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Clown Circus or Clown College, which was a real thing when Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus was a real thing, if the Clown College wanted to take over inner city ed, I would be like, why not?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Maybe they can fix it because we need to try. And I don't feel like doing the same thing as trying.
Yeah.
But so anyway, so Milei, we'll check in with him later. Yeah. But I don't know if I'm saying this guy's name right. But Bukele in El Salvador has been in power since 2019. So during that period, you have to know he went through the whole COVID thing. And the way U.S. had 10% inflation, you know that, and we're still having higher inflation than we ever had before 2020. That has really hit developing nations, right? They got none of the benefit of the inflation, none of the free money that went out with the inflation, and yet all of their imports went up, right? So this, we already covered this a long time ago, but like hunger in the world went way up during U.S. inflation, right? So he's been running El Salvador since then. And what has he done, right? Essentially what he did was gangs were essentially running El Salvador, and he just massively locked everyone up. And there's some really chilling documentaries about this that, you know, don't say they're for Bukele's policies or against. I just watched one that's about the new gang prison in El Salvador, where they've got 80 people per cell, and these bunk beds are stacked 5 high. And these cells are big. They're like the size of a gymnasium. And it's a chilling documentary when they walk through that gang prison, you know. But he's also grown the El Salvadorian economy by 50% in that time. And the murder rate went down so far. It's, you know, about a third of the U.S. murder rate now. Like, the murder rate went from over 50 people before he took office, depending on which, the last 3 years before he went office, it was in the 80s or the 50s per 100,000 was the murder rate. To give a context, the U.S. murder rate is 6 per 100,000. You know, 6 or 7. Now the El Salvadorian murder rate is around 2.
Yeah.
Right. And he's enormously popular.
Yeah.
But he's enormously unpopular with think tanks and people who care about civil
and, like,
rights.
Watch groups. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because essentially what they say they did was they built back in the old regime, they had built this incredible catalog of what tattoos meant, like what the gang tattoos were. And they just started sending people to jail for tattoos.
Well, they would basically surround whole towns and go door to door and be like, you look like you might be in a gang. Oh, you have that tattoo. Oh, we don't like the. I mean, they mass arrested people. And I think this is interesting because it's like both Argentina and El Salvador were like at crisis points, you know. And I think like Milei is trying to do something by going back to like more sound economic principles. I think that's like what he's trying to do, you know. And in a way, I kind of think that might be like a healthier thing, but I don't know. But it's like the people in El Salvador were so fed up or afraid or whatever that it's like, yeah, it's worth sacrificing kind of these basic civil liberties, you know.
Essentially sacrificing these people.
Yeah, but I think when you sacrifice those people, you don't know when you're arresting people without trial, et cetera, whatever, like when does that turn on you, you know?
Right. And, you know, even trials are imperfect.
They're kind of the trials most... are imperfect, but they are basically, he was just like, you know what? These people are bad. They're a bad force in our country. We're going to lock them up. And to do it, we have to do it fast and quickly. And we're not going to, you know, and
I want to add another layer to that. He even says that these people are, in a sense, irredeemable.
Yeah.
Like he's not going to kill them, but he has no plan to ever let them out and no plan to reform.
Right.
And frankly, when you watch these prison documentaries, El Salvador, they look very orderly. You're not seeing like people who look abused, you know, and you're still seeing people in those cells threaten the people who walk by with gang threats. You know what I mean? Like, it's very clear that the ethos of violence has not left them, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the idea here, I'm going to defend. I think we have to give Bukele his full defense and then we can attack him. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So basically they were in a reign of terror and the reign of terror was from the gangs and the government was an agent of the gangs.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So everything was screwed, you know? And he essentially went to war with the bad force in his country, you know? And if like you're in the Civil War, like imagine the Civil War is going on, right? And in a northern city, a man puts on a Confederate outfit and starts walking around downtown. You'd arrest him,
mm-hmm.
you know? And he'd be like, but you didn't catch me actually doing anything. You'd be like, yeah, but you're supporting the other side visually and openly. Right. So you're arrested. You know, we can't afford to let Confederate soldiers in uniform walk around Chicago during the Civil War. Right.
Yeah.
So he's just arresting people based on essentially their uniform, which is a tattoo uniform. Right.
Yeah.
He's mass incarcerating them. And then he's arguing that these people have been programmed. They've been programmed. And humans, more than any other animal, have this incredible like kind of... This is not a Catholic way of speaking, but they have incredible like software dimension to them. Like we are incredibly can be formed by our environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just all hardwired in who we are. Right.
Yeah.
And these people have been formed in great violence and their priorities are completely wrong. There is no proven way to reprogram them and to reform them. And they need to be out of the population. And we have no, you know, and I mean, I suppose if we discovered a way to reprogram them, we would. But until then, they're all just going to be locked up for the foreseeable future and there's no end in sight. Right. And now we're going to move on as a country. Right. So that and by the way, he is also economic for those Bitcoin lovers out there.
Yeah,
who need Bitcoin, the currency.
Right.
So I think his sound economically also. But like this law and order view of like essentially this is my civil war. We're locking all these people up. We took a bunch of prisoners of war. And the people in El Salvador believe it's worked. And my brother-in-law, who's in Costa Rican politics, he says that if Bukele ran for president of Latin America, he would win in a landslide. Like all the other Latin American countries are looking at El Salvador saying,
we want that.
Wow. Can we be more like them? Right. Yeah. So that's the case for him. Now, do you want to go? I felt like you were already launching into the case against him. So what do you got?
Oh, I mean, I think it's like the sort of civil protections that we value, you know, in the Western world, in the US, like have gone out the window.
Do you think though that argument, like, isn't it true that like our civil society functions only with, in a sense, a well-formed citizenry? Meaning like, it's not
well,
like
we
just...
do. We do actually, I mean, the Patriot Act was a suspension of that. Right. And, like we do have times where we're like, we're going to put this aside for a second emergencies.
And that's a normal government thing in history is that even if they believed in civil liberties, sometimes in an emergency, they suspend. And frankly, that's what Bukele says he's doing too. They've just been in a state of emergency since 2019 with no repeal in sight, you know?
Yeah.
But my point is though, that like, you can't just take American ideas of civil rights, choose any random country in the world that's struggling and just throw them in there and say, these rules will sort you out.
Yeah,
right?
No, I agree with that. Yeah.
All right. And therefore I don't really understand exactly what civil rights they had before Bukele went into office, but I don't think they were being observed either because essentially the government was a agent of the gangs, you know?
Yeah.
So couldn't it even be true that there are more civil rights now in El Salvador?
The other thing, though, like watch groups or whatever criticize about him is that, you know, he's like kind of like struck deals with the gangs. That's like, you behave and we'll treat you fine in jail or something. And I don't know. I'm like, I don't.
Whatever. I don't even know if that makes sense. I mean, of course, if prisoners behave, they get treated better in jail.
Yeah, or yeah, like it's like you behave on the outside and your people inside don't suffer. But
well, let's talk about these watch groups. So a guy like Bukele, by the way, on Twitter, his byline is Philosopher King.
Oh, yeah. He thinks he's like a messenger from God, by the way.
And what I kind of don't like about Bukele is he's way too young. He's like younger than me.
An instrument of God, he said. Yeah.
I hope. Yeah. No, there is problems here. Like, I mean, mm-hmm. I'm really worried that he will be king for life, basically. But
yeah.
And there won't be a way to get rid of him if he's not a just king. Yeah. But I think that these watchdog groups, he is a threat to a whole way of thinking.
Yeah.
Right. And if he succeeds, it discredits something.
Yes. Yeah. You know,
if people are better off and healthier and wealthier and wiser and living much more fulfilled lives in El Salvador because of Bukele, there is a certain type of liberalism that I'm in fact sympathetic to that gets a big hole blown in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
But I think that if you love truth, you'd need to not be afraid of that.
Right.
You know, but there are people writing hack jobs on him because he is that type of threat. He's a threat to ideology, you know.
Yeah.
Having said that, I'm not comfortable saying what he's doing is great. I do think I've got two El Salvadorian friends. I've only talked to one of them about this, and he was low key signaling, this is good. The other one I haven't talked to. And, when I did talk to her in the past, she talked about like, you know, if you're wealthy in El Salvador, you could live kind of safely. You basically lived in gated communities and you could go to the beach under these conditions and things like this. And it was like, they enjoyed visiting El Salvador back in the gang days, but it was also clear that they were in the upper class, you know?
Yeah.
And I wonder if this right here is just a better situation for the lower class, and for the overall people of El Salvador. And I've been to, you know, Simplash used to have that mission in Nicaragua, and we spent a week driving around Honduras, and it was dark. I mean, Honduras is a democracy. It's always been a democracy. They haven't had a civil war in 100 years, you know. And there was a darkness of people not looking you in the eye on street corners. There's a CFR mission down there. We talked to the priest who ran it. He talked about the prevalence of sexual abuse and stuff and how no one will stop it. And so he's just kind of stuck in this situation where he just like, there's no one to mandatorily report to, you know what I mean? There's no like mechanism of justice that's operating.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there was a darkness of just people not seeing how they can, proceed. And I think one of the tests that we need to have is like, if I was going to give you like only $1,000 to recreate your life and you had to choose a Latin American country, which one do you go to? You know, right now I'd still say Costa Rica, but I would take El Salvador above Honduras and Nicaragua, you know? And if that's true, then we have to kind of give this guy a little bit of credit.
Yeah.
You know,
Paraguay's supposed to be a sleeper. Good one.
Go ahead. What?
I said Paraguay's supposed to be a sleeper. Good one for your, info. You know, in case you have to go.
What do you call those countries that are like south of Mexico and north of Venezuela?
Oh, Central America.
Central America. Yeah. I was kind of limiting my search to that. If I had $1,000 and had to restart in Central America, I would choose Costa Rica. And then I don't know what I'd choose. I might choose El Salvador, you know?
Yeah.
And that was not true 5 years ago. You know?
Yeah, no way. Yeah.
So is this possible for us in the U.S., to get to a better place where, you know, it's a healthier worldview, healthier place for Catholicism to thrive, healthier place for us to just thrive as a people without a failed state.
Just to go back to the coding analogy, it would be like taking bad code out to get there. I don't know.
Yeah, you'd have to reboot, and failed states let you reboot because everyone's
but
desperate.
But rebooting is not always good, because I think if there is like a crisis that causes rebooting, there's a lot of fear, you know,
Right. And like, I think we're now seeing, like, due to us kind of demoralizing the police force, we have gotten to this turning point. It's like, hey, we want law and order back. I think we've seen this now. Like, we just saw this week that the National Guard in New York was sent down into the subway system in New York because of the increased crime.
Yeah.
And D.C. has a crime bill. And you said they're going after a certain city council member because he gutted the police force. Right.
Yeah.
So if we're going to go back and want more security, we have two roads before us. We have the loss of all privacy.
Yeah.
Right. And like a surveillance state road forward. Mm-hmm. Or we could just go do old fashioned policing, which also works. Right.
Yeah.
And that's interesting, you know. And so, like, which road do you take? And as far as the big picture, so one's more positive than the other in my mind. I don't want to go to a surveillance state. But this big picture reform, I wonder if the way it happens is we'll get a president who's got to be at least as popular as Obama was when he took office.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got to say, I'm doing a reorganization.
Yeah.
And a lot of companies, and even I've seen dioceses, have reforms and they don't call them reforms. You have to do them with some guys.
Yeah.
Right. Like when Trump said that he was going to move the USDA to Kansas City, that makes a lot of sense that the USDA would be in Kansas City. Right. Yeah. It also gives you the chance to,
like, weed some people out.
Yeah. Weed people out. Change who's running it. Change the culture of it.
I think this happens in schools when they're trying to do a big cultural change. They're like, we're going to keep all the old staff, but here are some changes that we're making. And the staff leave. You know, right. Except for the ones that can adapt and get on board, you know.
So essentially they tell the staff, you're very welcome to stay, even though they may not want them to. And then they do this, right?
Yeah. And then sometimes the staff will actually rise to the occasion, and that's awesome, you know.
Right.
And then a lot of people will say, this is not for me anymore. Yeah.
I know. I feel like this is a couple administrations ago now, so it's not something that's sensitive, but like in the DC diocese, I felt like things were pretty weird, like in the diocesan offices, like around the sex abuse crisis time. And then around 2008, there were layoffs. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to one of the guys who had worked in the layoffs, and I said, was this really an economic layoff? Is the diocese really struggling?
Yeah.
Or were you guys like kind of like reforming
cleaning
the diocese
house,
and getting everyone, cleaning house, getting everyone on the right page? And he goes, he just looked at me and he goes, let's just say everyone in the diocese is pulling the same direction now.
Mm.
Right. Yeah. And essentially they'd used a recession.
I'm not going to answer your question, but
they used a recession as cover fire for a reform, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's what the federal government would need.
Yeah.
Like if we're going to have a reform before failed state.
Yeah.
And maybe we've gone too far and covered too much ground, but I want to throw out two more ideas about the surveillance state thing. Do you want to take us a different direction? Go for it.
No, I think the surveillance state, I mean, I think that's a very real thing as people get fed up with crime in major cities that it's like they would have thought was kind of bad before, but will be like, whatever. Like, if that's going to keep me safe, sure.
So related to this, Tucker Carlson has made two kind of thesis statements that are interesting. He said these repeatedly. He says that without privacy, you cannot have democracy. And then he says, with state secrets, you cannot have democracy.
Those are opposites.
Like the citizens must have privacy.
Yeah.
And the state cannot be allowed to have privacy.
Yeah.
And that's interesting, you know?
It's like a surveillance is like the exact inverse of that. Like,
well, surveillance means no citizen privacy.
But and state secrets, because you're getting all this private information.
I don't know if that's
maybe not necessarily.
Yeah, not necessarily.
But,
right.
Yeah.
But like, for example, like if your state is allowed to say topple a regime or help elect a foreign president or something like that and is secret about it, then you've given them way too much power and there's not enough checks and balances. There's not enough see through, you know, type stuff. Right. And so therefore, you can't really have a democracy because of these you basically have this unhinged thing operating without having any real accountability to the people. But I do think you could probably have secrets like witness protection programs, safe houses, or a secret missile technology or something.
But you can't have drones killing citizens.
Right. You couldn't have big, dark budgets, you know? But on the other hand, with the privacy thing, I've talked to young people and I'll be like, man, I don't think this Google Gmail is like a good idea, you know, or they have access to everything you look at online and what ideas you're consuming, et cetera. And they'll say, all the old people care about privacy.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And I realized I had a hard time making an argument like what I was worried about. And then I said, do you think that at any point in your life, you're going to have to speak truth to power?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And they're like, of course, like they think that's their life, you know? Yeah, of course. Right. And it's like, well, then you're going to need privacy.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to need to be able to organize. You're going to be able to need to be able to think and develop ideas freely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that, power will crush you before you ever can speak truth to power.
Yeah. I was just, looking for a controversial medical fact online. And I was looking specifically for something I had read maybe 8 years ago. Impossible to find.
Wow.
And I was so disturbed by that, you know? and I was trying to do searches that wouldn't get me like hospital pages, university research, or like WebMD. Telling me a lot of people think this, but actually that is wrong, you know, and I couldn't, you know, I don't know. Anyway, I think it's just like not only the organizing, but we think we have free access to information and we don't. Yeah.
This is an episode that I think represents a lot of things Laura and I have talked about almost in private over the last so many months, you know, and I'm sorry if it doesn't hold together that well, but So the idea is that we're in a very fragile thought bubble right now.
Yeah.
We'd love to be in a healthy worldview that, you know, is not as easy to challenge and poke holes in and fragile, you know? Mm-hmm. And because what we're in is fragile, we know it's not stable.
Yeah.
And then the question is, will the new thing be better or worse?
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly for us as Catholics. And try to imagine good reform is hard. That's something to pray about and be prepared for. You know, I think that too often when we have these conversations with Catholic friends, everyone's convinced that everything becomes Mad Max Thunderdome. Everything goes back to the Stone Age. Like we have to our emergency like vegetable garden. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, vegetable gardens are okay, but I think there's a much bigger probability that things just get weirder, more difficult, harder to thrive, harder to just be like, there's just a tax on being Catholic.
Yeah,
and I don't mean a literal tax, but just like the harder it is to be Catholic, the more friends you're going to see fall away.
Yeah. I think pray about it, be ready for it. But I think an important thing is like, back to this idea of like the thought bubble, it is like guard against your own fragile thought bubbles, you know, and make yourself, resilient and able to engage whatever is coming, you know, because I think it's like if you're protecting your own thought bubble, you put yourself in a vulnerable position as well, you know, like,
right.
And just be like, when you're in that vulnerable position, other people have control of you, because if you're reacting out of fear or anger or whatever, like it gives other people a lot of power. So I don't know. That's
and
a weird
ultimately
idea,
that's kind of like what killed Christ.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to bring everything back to Christ, but everything does come back to Christ.
Christ starts here, according to Lydia.
but the idea being like the Pharisees were literally in a religious thought bubble,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so were the Sadducees, or they were more a political thought bubble than a religious one. And he was a threat,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they needed to kill him because he was too threatening to their thought bubble. Right.
Yeah.
And Catholicism is a threat to the current thought bubble. It really is. And you shouldn't be surprised if it gets labeled as that threat and gets persecuted as that threat. But what we really want to do is not just be a threat and get persecuted and glory in our persecution or something like this. What we really want to do is just help the world any way we can to get to a healthier state where people can thrive, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that I was thinking about this, like, idea of like local communities, parishes, and families. That's just this Catholic idea of personalism, that the world yeah. ultimately is interpersonal relationships. It's not mm-hmm. these big systems, you know?
Yeah.
And if you value that, I think you have to hold the big systems in check, because the family will always be a threat to mm-hmm. an overreaching state,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. because the state needs you to have allegiance to it and not to your own little core group, or you corrupt the state. Right.
Yeah.
So the family and an overreaching state are antithetical at some level. I think people have told me that for a long time now, and I've only recently actually understood it. It's only sinking yeah. in now that yeah. that's why the state has to, you know, hurt families, is because families literally are a threat. But it's only a threat to like an essential communist state, or a state that's trying to do everything for you.
Yeah.
You know? So would you say you're white-pilled or black-pilled? So white-pilled is the pill of hope. Black-pilled is the pill of doom. Are you a doomer or a hoper?
You know, I don't know how much of this comes down to natural disposition, but I'm generally like hopeful. We have hope.
I am. Well, I think we have to have this transcendental hope that even if things yeah. do become Mad Max Thunderdome, I am still believing in the victory of Christ. But yeah. I actually also, like you, I think part of the way you and I became friends is we are kind of hopeful.
Yeah.
But I kind of, I'm in tension, because like, although my natural disposition is hope, I feel my role as father, as being a dad,
yeah.
is to prepare for the worst. Like yeah. that's actually my job.
I think that's right. I think yeah. that's right.
So yeah. I'm doing quite a bit of like thinking about how, if things get bad, like what we need to do. Do we have a plan? Mm-hmm. Let's think about that. Right. And I don't mean Mad Max Thunderdome. I mean, just like little things, if things get rough, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the Strange Simpleton Podcast. Podcast you go for your strangest ideas to become a countercultural force.
Did we give people ideas how to do that? I don't know.
I don't know what we did either. I like to overclaim what we do,
yeah.
though.
Yeah.
All right. We'll go back to the manual probably next time. So.
Well, this is a rebuilding year for the podcast, so.
Just kidding. Wait, Laura and I are joking that when you declare something a rebuilding year, you're just asking for a pass.
Yeah.
So this is a rebuilding episode.
This is a rebuilding week for the podcast.
Yeah, so just give us a pass on this episode, and we'll see you next week. All right. Talk to you later, Laura.
All right. Bye, Clark.
All right, bye-bye.